This is Pet Life Radio. Let's talk pets.
Is your pet stressed out? Does your pet need annual vaccines? Which pet is best for a child? Would you know if your dog was in pain? Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor, where you'll learn everything about keeping your pet healthy and happy. From pet care, pet meds and grooming, to pet food, pet insurance and dental care, this is the place to find out everything there is to know about pet wellness. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets, because it's your pet. Health matters. Please welcome your Pet Doctor host, veterinary media consultant and veterinarian, Dr. Bernadine Cruz.
Fall, what a phenomenal time of year. A chill in the air, the perfect excuse for snuggling with your pet. And want to get a little exercise? How about a walk through trails strewn with leaves of fabulous colors? If you're a hunter, time to hit the fields with your trusty canine to fill the larder with game. Maybe your hunting is for tasty mushrooms with which to flavor your evening meals. But do you know which ones are safe to eat? Does your dog? Fall can also be a time of increased risk for both your pet, both inside and out of the home. My guest is Dr. Charlotte Flint. She has been a senior consulting veterinarian at Pet Poison Helpline since 2010. We're going to be right back after a short break, so sit, listen, stay.
Molly, here's your dinner. Zeus, that's not your food.
Don't let that happen to your precious cat. Elevate your cat's eating experience with the Cat Tree Tray. The Cat Tree Tray keeps your cat's food off the floor and conveniently located on the cat tree. It's the perfect way to eat. It's a beautiful wrought iron tray that easily attaches to your cat tree and keeps dogs and other critters out of your cat's dish. A must for multi-pet households. There's a 6-inch tray for large bowls and a 4-inch tray for smaller bowls. Purchase your cat tree tray today. Go right now to cattreetray.com. That's cattreetray.com. cattreetray.com.
Let's talk pets on PetLifeRadio.com. Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Flint, this is, I think, such an important subject because, okay, you know, during the summer, there's, you know, things that your pet can get into, and during the winter, you have to be concerned with, and, you know, we're always thinking about poinsettia plants, and again, that's probably not much of a major problem. But fall, I think that's a time of year that really people don't think about. What are some of the real problems that we run into in our fall season?
Sure. Yeah, there are a few that we really get a lot of calls on around fall. And I think it is one of those seasons that people don't think about. It's kind of a relax. We've been through the summer. Let's, you know, get into the snuggly fall time of year. But there are definitely some toxins that we see a huge pickup of calls about in the fall. I think probably the first thing that comes to mind for me would be the rodenticides. I know I live in a wooded area, and as the weather starts to get a little cooler, we see mice that are coming into the house looking for food and warmth as they're getting ready for winter, and I know that people are seeing that all over the country. And so we get a lot of calls because people are starting to see evidence of mice and occasionally rats, and they're putting those rodenticides out. Sometimes they're, you know, putting them in areas where unfortunately dogs can get to them or other pets can get to them, and so they're calling us. We definitely get a huge pickup on those rodenticide phone calls at this time of year.
Now, rat and bait has really changed a lot. So it used to be that you'd walk through the door and go, oh yeah, I know how I can handle this one, but it's better killing through chemistry. So yeah, please explain the difference in the types of rodenticides that are out there now.
Sure. There has been a change in how the EPA allows companies to sell baits. And because of that, we have seen a huge shift in ingredients that are more commonly on the market. I think the biggest one is that traditionally there have been these anticoagulant baits or baits that can cause issues with bleeding that people were using, they were familiar with, we think about it. this is a type that does have a pretty easy antidote too, which so it's kind of the upside of that type of bait. However, that's become a little bit more tightly regulated, and so we're seeing a lot more of a different ingredient called bromethylene on the market. Bromethylene is a different kind of bait that works by causing swelling of the brain and then neurologic symptoms if dogs get into enough of it. And that's a bait that unfortunately doesn't have an antidote. So it is one to really be careful about with pets in the home, especially cats, but certainly dogs, any type of pet, and one to really be very cautious to keep out of reach of those pets.
I found it interesting in the Journal of the American Veterinary Medical Association, October 1st, 2017, they had a really interesting map of the United States showing which states had problems with which types of toxicosis. In California, where I am, and it looks like it was by 25 different states, the biggest problem was this bromethylene rat bait. Why was it brought out? Why was it thought that it was safer than the anticoagulant? Or I should just ask, why do they come out with it?
It's one that's been on the market for a while, and I think that's sort of a complicated question. My understanding with the EPA is that they had a lot of reports of pets and also children getting into the anticoagulant baits and responded by more tightly regulating the sale of those types of baits. And then manufacturers, as a response to that, they want something to sell to consumers who are having mouth problems, said, okay, we're going to go with this other category, this other class, the bromethylene baits. And so it was sort of filling a hole kind of response to it. And it is something that has certainly caused a lot of issues for pets. I think it's been a bit of an awareness issue for pet owners and also veterinarians that I think there was a lag in people really realizing that this change had been made, and pets that get into rodenticides are not always what they had been in years past, which I think has also been a big issue too.
And the problem's not just for the cat or dog, hopefully, my goodness, that you don't have a child getting into this, but they are attracted to it because it's sweet in many times. But then if you have a rat that's died outside and the cat goes, ooh, this is pretty good, I don't even have to go chase it, I can just eat it. It's not just the rat that has the problem, it's the next generation of consumer.
Potentially. That's something that we actually don't see a lot of issues with mice that are causing what's called a relay toxicity, where pets ingest that poisoned mouse or rats. Theoretically, if they get into enough mice or rats, potentially that could be an issue. But fortunately, there's not a lot to worry about if a dog or a cat gets into the occasional mouse or rat. That relay toxicity is usually going to be a low risk, though it certainly depends on how much of their diet is being made up of mice and rats.
I like that. So I'm learning something new. Now, does the same thing hold true for, say, a raptor, that bird of prey that takes the mouse or rat?
That, I think, is part of why the EPA did some of the changes in regulating these rodenticides, the anticoagulant types of rodenticides. Again, if they're having a large part of their diet that is made of poisoned mice or rats, that potentially could be an issue for wildlife, including raptors and other birds. You know, we always say the dose makes the poison, and this would certainly be that situation for the wildlife as well. Depends on how much of it they're getting into and how much of their diet is made of these poisoned animals.
So, Dr. Flint, what would be the signs that you could see, either with the bromethylene, the one that causes the brain swelling, or the older-fashioned anticoagulant? What would a pet owner see?
So with the anticoagulant, one nice thing about it is that we have time. That type of bait isn't going to cause any symptoms right away, though sometimes you'll see the color, the dye that's added to the bait show up in a pet's stool. And then typically,
what color is that?
It would depend on whatever color that is. A lot of times there'll be a green or a blue color or a teal color, but there are some red and yellow baits that are out there too, but almost all the manufacturers will add some type of dye so that we can watch the stool and know if an animal has eaten that bait. For the anticoagulants, usually you don't see anything other than that change in the stool, potentially, But then several days later, usually 3-4 days later, these pets will start to bleed. And sometimes you'll see some external bleeding or bruising, things like bloody noses, blood in their stool or urine or vomit. Sometimes these pets will bleed internally where you don't see anything on the outside and you have a dog or a cat that would just lose their energy. They don't want to play like normal. Sometimes their gums could look pale. They sometimes will be coughing. And so that's always a big thing I watch out for. Or changes in breathing, heavier breathing, more labored breathing would be another thing to keep an eye out for as well. Unfortunately, cats, that's the one time where cats kind of have the upper hand. They do tend to be much less sensitive to the anticoagulant baits as compared to dogs. So not too much of an issue for cats in most situations.
Great.
For the bromethalin baits, that type would have usually a little bit sooner onset. In many cases, depends a little bit on the details, but in many cases we'll start to see something within 24 hours, so occasionally can be delayed several days. But these pets will develop swelling of their brain, and so we're looking more for changes in behavior and the neurologic kind of symptoms. So sometimes they'll be quieter than normal. Dogs and cats will sometimes get more excitable or a bit agitated. They often will have some changes in how they walk, especially some weakness and wobbliness and in coordination of their back legs. We can sometimes see things like tremors or shaking and potentially things like seizures as well. And often they'll just be very weak all over their body. So those changes in their behavior and how they walk are big things to watch for with the bromethalin baits.
And you said there is no treatment for that.
There isn't. No, we really focus on trying to get those pets into the clinic right away and doing things to try to get that type of bait out of their body before they absorb it. So we're typically doing things like inducing vomiting to try to get it out of the stomach, giving doses of charcoal to try to absorb that bait that might be left behind. And then if we catch them once some time has passed and they've had symptoms develop, then we really are left with treating the symptoms and trying to support them through. And we have had pets that have had good outcomes. They've gotten into it. I always encourage people to try, even if they have a pet that does get symptoms from bromethalin. But it is unfortunately something that does take quite a while to get out of the body. And sometimes pets are treated for a long amount of time, many days, sometimes even weeks, and occasionally are left with some permanent neurologic deficits. So it's definitely one to be cautious about.
So what does Pet Poison Helpline recommend for safe rodent control? You know, close all windows, check all crawl areas that they can get into. But if you have some mice, rats that got into the house and you need to use something to trap them, kill them, what do you recommend?
I think there are a few good options out there. I think certainly doing things like the traditional snap traps can be a good option with pets in the home. They often will come in these little enclosed things where even a curious cat can't get their paw stuck in there, and there certainly wouldn't be any poisoning kind of situation. You know, certainly like you mentioned, sealing up the home, making sure they can't get in is always that prevention's the best medicine. If you are going to choose to use the types of rodenticides that are on the market, I think, and I'll tell you as a pet owner, I have, when we've had mice come in, I look for the anticoagulant types of baits. They do have an antidote in case a pet gets into it. They tend to be a safer choice, and they are still out there. You just sometimes have to look a little bit harder, but they definitely are on the market still. And I always, always recommend using bait stations. I think bait stations are great, partially just to keep pets from, you know, hopefully getting into it at all. Some of them are plastic where a pet can chew into them, but at least if it's in a bait station, it's going to slow that pet down where hopefully we can stop them from getting into it sooner. And we at least know that they've gotten into a very limited amount. Most of these bait stations will hold one block, and it's a huge difference between a pet that gets into one block of mouse or rat poison as compared to a pet that gets into a whole bag of it, which we unfortunately get calls about. So using those bait stations and putting them out of reach, I think, is so important too.
One of the other thing I know that clients oftentimes tell me they've used, and especially these are the, I think, Buddhist at heart of nothing will die in my house. I'm going to trap it, get rid of it, is using the sticky traps. And I think it seems to work better on mice than it does on rats. Rats just seem to be smart and walk around the things. You know, you do go in and you find this little mouse who's stuck to this like super duper fly paper stuff that they can't get off of. And it's like, okay, now what do you do with it? But as I understand, and I've had people do it, getting vegetable oil, and you just kind of drive them off someplace to a field someplace away from the house, slather them down with all of this vegetable oil. They'll probably get some diarrhea from licking themselves clean, but then they're allowed to just kind of detach themselves from that sticky trap, and they go on to live their lives a little greasy, but someplace not in your home.
Yes, that's a good choice too. Or there are little live traps too, that are always an option as well. They'll have heart traps and things like that where you can catch them and then release them elsewhere that's more appropriate for them to live.
Yes, relocating these guys. Well, speaking of relocating, you have your dog that's in your backyard in the house, and this is your hunting dog, and you live in an area where you're going to go hunting. Well, that seems like, you know, other than maybe getting shot by somebody who doesn't have very good aim and doesn't realize it's a dog, what are some of the other problems for hunting dogs?
There are a few things that hunting dogs will come across as they're out there, they're in the woods, they're in the fields, they're in areas that our typical city dogs or even suburb dogs aren't going to come across that I think about during hunting season. And here in Minnesota, we've got a lot of hunting dogs. So one question that comes up often would be lead, which is often in bullets or different shotgun shells. That's something that we'll sometimes deal with hunting dogs. Sometimes there are things out there in the great outdoors, such as wild mushrooms, different molds we'll sometimes come across, blue-green algae, like in ponds that they may be hunting around. And then I always think about, you know, in addition to these toxins, they're just things like ticks that are out there that could spread disease, snakes in some areas of the country, and then we just see some wounds and trauma, grass-ons, lacerations, that dogs that are so focused on the hunt, they run through barbed wire. Those are things to keep in mind as well.
All right, sounds like we have a lot to go over, but first let's take a short break. We're going to be right back, and my guest is Dr. Charlotte Flint, a senior consulting veterinarian at Pet Poison Helpline. So we're going to get right back, talk about these hunting dogs and what they get exposed to.
Please have a seat in the waiting room. The doctor will be with you shortly, right after these messages.
Does your dog itch, scratch, stink, or shed like crazy? Come to Dynavite for help.
Order a 90-day supply of Dynavite.
Everything we tried failed except the Dynavite.
Pick up two bottles of Super Mega Fish Oil.
Get the third bottle free. Packed with omega-3, DHA, and EPA fatty acids.
Super Mega is great for your dog's immune system, healthy skin, and soft, shiny fur.
Dogs love it. Try Super Omega Fish Oil.
Buy two, get one free.
At Dynavite.com.
Dynovite.com.
Let's talk pets.
Let's talk pets.
On Pet Life Radio.
Pet Life Radio.
PetLifeRadio.com.
Welcome back to the Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. The doctor is in, and we'll see you now.
Dr. Flint, okay, you mentioned blue-green algae. That's not just a problem, if I understand, because here in Southern California, we get told about it, but we don't have a lot of water. Wish we did. We would have less fires. But tell us a little bit about this blue-green algae, cyanobacteria.
So blue-green algae is a type of algae that will often bloom during this type of year. We think about it blooming or kind of growing out of control during times of warmer weather, especially kind of when it's dry, the winds are calm, especially in slow-moving or nutrient-dense waters. So sometimes ponds that get a lot of runoff from fertilized fields or yards will grow this as well. We tend to see more of it again in late summer and fall in the northern U.S., but it can happen all year round in the southern and warmer areas of the country. Things that I look for when I'm thinking about blue-green algae, though unfortunately it's not something that you can identify with the naked eye, but I'm looking for this thick pea green, thick mat of algae that's on the surface of water. Sometimes it will be a different color, brownish or reddish, and sometimes it'll have kind of a bad smell to it too, kind of a rotting sort of plant type of smell. So those would be things that would catch my attention and would give me pause in letting my dog get into that water.
Is this something that if you're out there hiking with your dog and you see it, because I'm just thinking about some of the waterways around my home here, and I'm seeing it has this green mat on top. Do I just let all my pet owners know? Do I contact my city government and saying, can you test that and see what it is?
Sure, there are a few options there. If you're seeing some water that worries you, especially if it's an area where pets may be, you certainly can check with your city government. I know around here we've had ponds that will sometimes get posted as a caution area, that it's been tested by the local, either public health service or the Department of Natural Resources locally will test it, and they will label it. They will say, hey, keep out, we've tested, this is blue-green algae. If you're just not sure and you're seeing that kind of scummy, foul-smelling water that looks suspicious, it's always a better safe than sorry situation to just keep your pet out of it. And then you certainly can contact, again, either the local public health service or a local Department of Natural Resources and see if you can get that water tested. Usually if we have a suspicious exposure, what we recommend is getting a gallon of water with the bloom in it, with the algae in it, keeping it chilled, and then contacting them for testing. Also, a lot of the local veterinary schools may have tox labs that could test for that type of algae as well.
And what signs, again, are you going to see?
There are two types of toxins that can be in blue-green algae. There's one that is a neurotoxin, and when pets get into that, we're going to see a very, very rapid onset of symptoms, usually within an hour. And these pets will often have muscle rigidity. They could have trouble breathing, tremors or shaking, seizures, difficulty moving. Sometimes we'll also see symptoms like drooling and vomiting and having diarrhea going along with that. There's also the potential for liver toxins in blue-green algae. And typically, we'll also see rapid onset of symptoms within 1 to 4 hours. These pets will often just become lethargic. They lose their energy. They can be vomiting and having diarrhea, which sometimes can have some blood in it. They'll look pale. They'll be weak. And they then will go into liver failure. Sometimes that's something that will develop within 24 hours, but it can sometimes occur over the next several days. But usually you'll start to see some symptoms very rapidly.
Is treatment very effective?
Unfortunately, with blue-green algae, no. Typically, these pets do, in most cases, have a poor outcome, and many of them die. And because those toxins have such a rapid onset of symptoms, we usually can't do things to prevent them from absorbing the toxins and being affected by them. And a lot of times, unfortunately, by the time they get into the clinic, it's too late. Not always, and I always try. But unfortunately, this is a very, very serious toxin for pets. It's so rapid, and it can be very deadly.
Dr. Flint, you brought up something I thought that was interesting, and my ears immediately perked up talking about lead. And yes, these hunting dogs being exposed to the lead in the shot. I know right now in California we're trying to change it that none of that shot can have lead because of the fear of the wild animals getting exposed to it and causing problems there. But thinking, all right, Flint, Michigan, lead in the water, we've heard all about that, all the problems that they've had. Areas like that, Flint, Michigan, where the people are being exposed, how about the pets being exposed?
There's definitely possibility for pets in that area to be exposed, and we've talked to some veterinarians in that area of the country. With lead, I worry the most when it's ingested. So lead in the water is a big concern, lead paint chips that are ingested. With wildlife around here in Minnesota, get a lot of reports of waterfowl that will as they're trying to catch food and you know, eating in ponds and lakes, they'll eat some of those lead bullets or fragments that end up in the water. So that ingestion, getting it into the stomach and then absorbing it through the GI tract, is usually going to be our biggest worry with lead. And we do worry the most about young pets. So puppies, kittens, the youngsters are typically going to be the most sensitive to lead. And the types of symptoms that we see, usually it'll start with some stomach upset symptoms, so things like vomiting and diarrhea, and then it has potential to cause some neurologic signs as well. So things like changes in behavior, potentially could see some changes in things like their gait, how they walk, some incoordination, possibly things like some tremors and seizures could happen as well.
And those are so indistinct, you know. I would just be hard-pressed, something walks through the door, a puppy that's acting strange, going, you know, the whole myriad of differential diagnosis of what could be causing this. To test for lead toxicity, you know, you'd ask all the typical questions. Is there a sample that you could send in easily enough to have this diagnosed?
There is. So typically for lead, we'll send out blood levels, and that's something that most veterinary labs can test for, and usually we can get a result back within a day or two. So those blood levels are probably the most common type of test, and there are even, I think, some little over-the-counter kits, though not really validated for veterinary medicine. I prefer the veterinary labs run them. Sometimes we'll find things out also by actually taking an x-ray. You have a pet that gets, you know, they come in with these kind of vague symptoms. You're not sure what's going on. They end up getting an x-ray, and we find this little piece of what looks like metal in their body. And that will sometimes give us a clue and lead everyone to start wondering about the possibility of lead.
Just talking right now about taking an x-ray makes me think of, yes, all the things that pets will ingest. But oftentimes, pennies. Now, I can't remember exactly the period of time, but the way that coins are now minted is different than it was 40 years ago. So what is it about pennies, and correct me if I'm wrong, that it's pennies now are different as to if you ingest pennies, that can really be very toxic?
That's true, yes. So pennies that are dated after 1982 are actually going to be 97% zinc. We think of them as copper pennies, but the modern pennies are actually mostly composed of zinc. And when pets ingest a coin, a penny, that zinc material, or sometimes they'll eat, you know, screws or other pieces of hardware or toys that also are made of zinc, what can happen is that zinc will sit in the stomach, it'll leach out, their body will absorb it, and it will cause damage to their red blood cells, where we can see some severe anemias develop.
The things they put in their mouth, well, putting things in their mouth, in the intro I was talking about mushrooms, and I know there are people who love going out, and they're really very good at it most of the time, and find these wild mushrooms, and their flavors are just spectacular versus the little brown mushroom things you find at the grocery store. But our pets oftentimes are out there and they're curious, and there's this thing that's on the lawn or as they're snuffling through the wooded areas. What's the problem with mushrooms?
Well, I think the biggest problem with mushrooms is that they are just so hard to identify accurately. Sometimes we have, you know, people that do that mushroom hunting, they're very knowledgeable. They know what those edible mushrooms are. And typically, if it's okay for a person to eat, it's usually, and when you speak about mushrooms, going to be okay for dogs too. Probably the biggest issue we have is those mushrooms that are just growing in the yard or at the park or in the woods where you're hiking, and we just don't know what they are. And because they're so difficult, they do really truly require a mycologist, so a mushroom expert, to identify them accurately. This is something where those mushroom experts are usually doing things like looking at the growth patterns of the mushrooms on the ground. They are looking and counting the number of gills on the bottom of the mushroom. It's not something where I'm ever going to confidently give any identification based on a photograph of a mushroom or a part of a mushroom. And so because those wild mushrooms are so difficult to identify, we typically are going to treat any wild mushroom ingestion as possibly poisonous. A lot of times it's not a big deal, but we don't want to miss that odd case where it does end up being a very serious poisonous kind of mushroom.
So bring the mushroom with you to the veterinarian just in case. Typically, I get them to vomit, so I induce vomition. And I'd say most of the time, I've never had a problem. But what are some of the signs that you can see when this is a bad mushroom?
So there are basically five categories of mushrooms that are out there in the world. There are a lot of mushrooms that don't cause any symptoms or maybe just cause a little stomach upset, like some mild vomiting and diarrhea. And fortunately, tons of mushrooms, the majority of mushrooms are in that category. I think the mushrooms we worry about the most are things like Amanita mushrooms that have the potential to cause liver toxicity and liver failure.
Now, are there those the death cap mushrooms?
Those are the death cap mushrooms, okay. Yes. Yes, exactly. There are hallucinogenic mushrooms. There are mushrooms that can cause neurologic signs like seizures. And then there are what are called the muscarinic mushrooms that cause things like drooling and vomiting and diarrhea and these body secretions to kind of release. So those also can be out there in the world and a toxicity worry for dogs.
So the best thing to do is really try to convince your dog, don't eat them.
Yes. I usually, in terms of pet owner advice, recommend just checking your yard frequently. A lot of these dogs are getting into them right in their own backyard. So checking the yard, cleaning them up, trying to avoid letting your dog eat wild mushrooms if you're there and you can, which I know is always easier said than done. And then if you do have a wild mushroom that your dog or your cat eats, I generally recommend trying to save a sample of it. I'll wrap it in a paper towel, put that in a paper bag, and then save it in the refrigerator, labeling it so there's no accidental ingestion later on, and then trying to get somebody locally, a mycologist, to identify it for us.
Well, we've been talking about rat bait, you know, so that could be a problem inside the house, rodenticides, and a lot of these problems outside. Another inside one would be something like mothballs. It's like, oh, you hate having those. You take out your favorite sweater, you're going to put it on, you're looking forward to it, and there's these stupid little holes because the moths have been eating your sweater. So you go, fine, I'm going to put out mothballs. A cat saying, ooh, look at these little white things that are running around. It's easy for me to play with. Or a dog, again, putting everything in their mouth. What's the problem with mothballs?
Well, there are a few different kinds of mothballs that are on the market. And I would say that the more toxic one would be what are called the old-fashioned or the naphthalene mothballs. And they often will say old-fashioned mothballs on the package, and they'll have that kind of classic mothball odor. So with those, if pets ingest enough of them, they have potential to cause stomach upset symptoms, so things like vomiting and lack of appetite. Sometimes they'll be vomiting. It'll smell like mothballs and let us know that the pets ingested it. It can sometimes also cause things like seizures. Sometimes it'll cause some changes to the red blood cells, too, where they will not be able to carry oxygen normally or can cause some anemias as well. And there are some other less toxic mothballs that are out there. The newer, more modern ones will have something called paradichlorobenzene or PDB in them. And they tend to be a little bit safer. Usually we're seeing more of the stomach upset symptoms. So if they get into huge amounts, potentially could see some effects on the red cells. But they do tend to be quite a bit safer.
If you could, because I know there's just so much that we can go into that our pets can get exposed to, we sometimes don't even think, in just like a minute, real quick wrap-up of food products, decorations, what should people really be aware of?
I think a lot of it is just prevention. So I think sometimes everyone is, they're getting ready for the party, they're excited, and they're leaving, you know, big bowl of candy out. They're leaving big meal of food on the table. They don't think that the dog's around. The dog comes up and eats the chocolate or eats the bones, eats the food that's set out or the cookies that are set out. So I think just being mindful and keeping those foods either up high or shut away where the dogs can't easily reach them is, you know, kind of the very safest option. I know I also tend to, I just pay a little attention to ingredients because I have dogs and cats at home. So I'm trying to just keep some of these trouble things out of my home. So I'm not buying sugar-free items with xylitol. just because I have kids and I know they might drop something and my dog might get it and I don't have to worry about that. Same with things like raisins. Those are the things that my kids will bring home that they don't want to eat. Those are left behind. And my dog will certainly be happy to eat that box of raisins. So I go through that bag of candy when they come home and I pull some of those things out. And we also have a lot of issue with backpacks. So kids are at school and they've had a little party. Nobody thinks about the backpack because it usually just has papers in it. But if there's been a little party or something at school, just checking that backpack and getting the raisins or the candy or the gum out of there before your dog gets to it is a great, great idea.
And you're right, it's usually the dogs, but cats will do bad things also, you know, being curious. I'll always remember I had made this gorgeous chicken, baked it, and it was on top of the stove, and it was just cooling. And I came back later, it's like, huh, I know I had that chicken on top mm-hmm. of the stove, and there's still the pan that it came out of, but where's the chicken? And here's my cat, and this was a large chicken, and it wasn't a large cat. It was in the corner of the room, and the cat was just munching away, happy as ever. It's like, thanks. So yes, our kitties will do things also. Dr. Charlotte Flint, if people wanted more information and how to get in touch with Pet Poison Helpline, where should they go?
They can always call us. We're here 24/7 at 1-800-213-6680. And we also have a great website with a lot of information for pet owners at www.petpoisonhelpline.com.
And we'll have all that information on our website, too. So, Dr. Charlotte Flint, thank you very much for being with us today. Good information, and hopefully people don't need to call you, but it's great to know that you're there in case they do.
Thank you.
This is Dr. Bernadine Cruz. You've been listening to The Pet Doctor on Pet Life Radio. Thank you very much for listening. Please tune in again next week. We'll give you more information on how to make you the best possible pet owner. Thanks for listening.
Pets can be a wonderful addition to your life because they're a member of the family. Keeping them healthy and happy is important. Pet Life Radio presents The Pet Doctor with veterinary media consultant and veterinarian Dr. Bernadine Cruz. Whether you have a dog, cat, reptile, or rabbit, you'll find answers for your pets straight from the vets. The Pet Doctor, on demand every week, only on PetLifeRadio.com.